Welcome to this session on women in the ministry. I'm Lavina Fielding Anderson, and I'm conducting this session. I want to thank Bill Russell for facilitating it. If it hadn't been for his email activity, we couldn't have got all these people together in the same room at the same time. This is a topic that is very close to my heart. In the spring, I was reading the Herald, which is the equivalent of the Ensign for the Community of Christ, and the President's Message by Steve Veazey, their president, talked about the significance of the anniversary of the 20th anniversary of ordaining women to the priesthood. And I thought, gee, I wish I were reading this in the Ensign. And he talked in very warm and appreciative terms about what it meant to him personally to share ministry with a woman when he was asked, who was threatening a miscarriage, and asked him for a blessing. That, and of course he was willing and eager to give the blessing, but he said, he talked about how much it meant to him to have a woman who was an evangelist share that priesthood blessing with him, because he knew that she was able to relate to that young mother in a way that he was not. And he continued by saying that in the years that women have held priesthood ministry in the Community of Christ, that he has seen a more egalitarian, more consensus-building style of leadership develop that he thinks is more truly Christ-like. And that meant a great deal to me to read that. And then as I read a little further in the magazine, there was a little report in the news section on interviews with children who had just taken the preparation for baptism class. And the reporter asked each child, now, who's going to baptize you? Who's going to baptize you? And one of them said, my grandma. She's coming all the way from Michigan. And it's a long way, but she says it's important. And I thought, yes, it is important. So that was extremely meaningful to me. Especially since I had just finished reading Susan Tanner's talk at the Young Women's Session of General Conference. And I admire and respect Susan Tanner, but one of the main points of her message was, young women, you're in high school now, and you're working hard for good grades, and you're getting recognitions and awards for being in, for doing extracurricular activities, and engaging in all these worthwhile places where your achievements are recognized. But when you are a wife and a mother, get over it, because you're not going to get any, that's not part of what will happen in the job description. I'm paraphrasing her, of course. And I remember thinking, well, on the one hand, I've got to give her credit for giving a realistic view of the job. But on the other hand, I thought, if I were a young woman sitting in that audience and I had been staying up late at night to study for tests, if I had been working hard to perfect my language skills, if I had been going to rehearsals for a dramatic performance or putting in extra hours for a choir, I would have just been told that those were immature activities, and that when I was grown up, I would realize that they were basically trivial. And that was not a message I would have wanted my daughter to hear, or for that matter, any young woman of the church. So I have deep and conflicted feelings about this whole topic of women in ministry, women's ministry, and women in the ministry. And I hope that we'll be able to share a lot of those feelings now. But ministry has it's not a term that is particularly widespread in Mormonism, although, again, from my reading in the Herald, I would say that it's roughly equivalent to either job or assignment or calling in Mormonism. For instance, there was a little news report about a woman who had a clown ministry, which meant that she did a clown act in a clown costume and would help go to hospitals and help sick children, or a music ministry, or a youth ministry, or an outreach ministry. So I think you can see that many of the activities would be the same, even though the term would be somewhat different. I think that one of the differences, though, is that you can perhaps in the community of Christ feel a calling to a ministry that would be more volunteer than perhaps the equivalent would be in Mormonism. I think for Mormon women, this particular type of ministry that I'm referring to would be more confined to child care and casseroles. And I don't want you to misunderstand what I'm saying. Those are very important, but are they, and often they are the most important activities. Child care is irreplaceable, but are they the only important activities? And I think that is another one of the questions that we want to explore when we're talking about ministry. We're very fortunate today to have as our first speaker Susan Score, and some people have asked me how to address an apostle, and if it were a very formal occasion where everyone was being addressed by title and surname, it would be Apostle Score or Elder Score, but if you ask Susan, it's Susan. So you can feel perfectly free to address her as Susan. Susan has been a member of the Council of the Twelve in the Community of Christ since June of 2005, just a little over a year. The Council of the Twelve Apostles is the leading missionary quorum in the Community of Christ, and she is in charge of the Western USA mission field, which includes the Arizona Mission Center, the Greater Pacific Northwest Mission Center, the Inland West, the Rocky Mountain Mission Center, the Sierra Pacific, the Southern California, the Southwest International, which includes Mexico, Mission Center, and that includes Utah. So we're part of her ministry. Susan has been a full-time minister since 2002, and her previous assignments include the Central Pacific Region President and Sierra Pacific Mission Center Financial Officer. Before becoming a full-time minister, Susan served the Seattle State Office of the Community of Christ as Secretary, Office Manager, and Assistant, an Executive Assistant, and has also been Youth Director of the Seattle State. She was born in St. Joseph, Missouri, and graduated from Lincoln Heath American High School in Great Britain. She has a degree in biology with a minor in chemistry from Saginaw Valley University and a Master of Arts degree in religion from Graceland University. Did she take classes from you, Bill? Christine. she was raised in an Air Force family and has experienced a variety of cultures, American, French, Japanese, Spanish, and English, and she's refreshing her Spanish so that she can address Spanish-speaking congregations in Spanish, and she says that they have been so gracious about helping her. She has traveled for pleasure in the British Isles and Western Europe. Nadine Hansen is a semi-retired attorney living in Cedar City, Utah. She and her husband have four children and four grandchildren, and Zachary, who's crawling on the floor back there, is definitely a front runner for cutest baby at Sunstone this year. In the past year, she has developed a variety of skills required to renovate an old house, including framing walls, hanging sheetrock, taping and texturing drywall, laying tile, and installing siding. Despite her heretical ways, and that's all she said about that, but I first encountered Nadine when I was sitting at my desk at the Ensign office and read an article about an attorney's view on the Equal Rights Amendment, and I thought, who is this woman? And I'm so glad I know. She has managed to serve in a variety of church positions, including teaching various classes, serving in a youth detention center, that was a calling, not a location, being the Relief Society president for the 9 months she was expecting her youngest child, and her favorite calling of choosing and leading the music in sacrament meeting. She and her husband are hiring most of the work done on the new home that they're building. She will actually be speaking third. Our second speaker is Vicki Eastman. She's a frequent participator on Sunstone panels dealing with Mormon culture and feminist issues. Vicki taught gospel doctrine for four straight years, giving her an opportunity to teach all the books of scripture. She and her husband, Alan, the bright yellow shirt over here, are the co-editors of the Righteous Domination column in Sunstone Magazine, which is a place to recognize stories of Christ-like leadership within the church. Professionally, she is a freelance executive recruiter. She is the mother of four grown children, and she and Alan live in Salt Lake City. She has a BA in English from Stanford University. Okay, we'll hear from them, Susan, then Vicky, then Nadine, and they've each prepared about 20 minutes. So that will take the first hour, and then we have a full half hour for response and questions, interaction with the audience, but also interaction with the panel. And I've waited till the very last moment to make this announcement because in every session I've been in, the person in charge has asked people to turn off their cell phones. And in every session I've been in, some cell phone has gone off. So if you are in possession of a cell phone, take it out right now, look at it, and be sure that it is turned off, because I have a zero tolerance policy for cell phones, and you don't want to see me if I hear a cell phone. And having brought that sweet spirit into the room, we will now turn the time over to Susan.
Thank you, Lavina. Lavina has not only become a good friend of mine, she's also my hostess. I'm staying in her home while I'm here, and that has just been a joy and a treasure. Thank you, Lavina.
She's also the perfect guest.
Oh, it's because I'm gone all the time. A year ago last April, as I worked on my computer, my email message popped up from Steve Veazey. He was the newly designated prophet president of the Community of Christ, and I assumed it was an announcement about the upcoming World Conference in Independence. I continued working for two more hours before I opened it. Then it read, "Confidential, top secret, Susan, I would like to visit with you and your husband in your home in Sacramento. I can travel to your area for the meeting. Would you be available Thursday evening or Friday morning of this week? Please don't mention this to anyone else. Yours in Christ, Steve Veazey." Panic and dire scenarios raced through my mind, most of them having to do with church finances, since I was at the time the Mission Center financial officer. By the time Steve actually arrived, my husband John and I had concluded he would be asking me to assist in a leadership position. Even so, when he asked me to be an apostle, I felt like I'd been punched in the stomach. I literally said, "Oof." And recovering, I said, "Steve, you need to know I have no confirmation of this call at all. I have no sense that God wants me to be an apostle. And furthermore, you don't know me." Well, it was true. We had met once and had a conversation when I was hired by the Community of Christ 3.5 years previously to be a full-time appointee, as we call them, a full-time minister for the church. I wasn't what you would call, an obvious candidate. I was raised in an Air Force family. I moved around the globe every 2 years from France to America to Japan to Spain to England. Both my parents were strong, dominant, and independent. The traditional gender roles that they attempted to model got blurred, and they shifted due to my dad's often assignment TDY, temporary duty yonder, as we called it. My mother's strength, creativity, and intellect kept the family together. Both parents engendered in me both a belief that I could do anything and a call to excellence in everything I attempted. I set my sights on science, research biology, as a matter of fact, and I went at it with a single-mindedness of purpose that only wavered when I met a friendly, outgoing art teacher named John Score. Abandoning science seemed a minor price to pay for the privilege of marrying him. And I've never regretted my choice to give up science to become a wife. John was an elder, and I enjoyed assisting him as a young wife and mother of two charming daughters who are now grown, by the way. My oldest has a grandchild. No. Has a child, who is my grandchild. John would discuss his sermons with me, explain his ministry, and ask my advice in handling pastoral concerns. We did work as a team. Gender issues were the farthest thing from my mind. I was happy to serve in any way possible. I never thought of ordination for myself. When we moved to Seattle in 1980, jobs were hard to come by. The Seattle Stake was looking for a youth director, and in sheer desperation, I applied. At that time, I had only my background as a Girl Scout and a brief summer of service in the Older Youth Service Corps of our church to rely on. But the Stake president, as he said later, saw something in me, and put that in quotes, and he risked giving me the job. No one in the Stake seemed surprised that an unknown, unordained young woman was responsible for the youth ministry for the whole Stake. When President Prophet Wallace B. Smith presented the revelation in 1984 that opened the door for ordination to women, I was stunned. It had never been a big issue for me. I had not been one of the voices calling for gender equality in the church. There had been those in the church who had challenged the exclusively male priesthood, who had tried to legislate for women's ordination, who had actively worked toward raising the awareness of the membership toward gender issues. But I had not been one of them. In general, there are three possible paths of change when an organization begins moving from patriarchal structure to gender inclusiveness. The first path is revolution. Women demand leadership, and they wrest it from the men, leaving in their wake damaged relationships, broken families, and tarnished ideals that take decades to heal. The second path is that of grace. Enlightened, self-actualized men who are stable and spiritually mature graciously invite women to step into leadership roles, and they do all they can to ensure a mutually empowering environment. That's ideal, and it seldom happens. Our church walked a middle path between the two. Utilization of women's giftedness expanded in the 1970s in many of the congregations and camp programs of the church. Strong, outspoken women in independence banded together to be a voice for inclusion, and through their efforts, a growing awareness of the potential in ordination of women began to permeate the church. Marge Tro, the director of women's ministries, worked cooperatively with male leadership to bring new, creative input to world church functions and activities. Leadership partnered with skilled women on many projects. Several jurisdictions brought resolutions proposing ordination of women, all of which were ruled out of order, or tabled, or voted down. Then in 1984, Prophet President Wallace B. Smith, in a revelation that caused him great struggle, brought an inspired message about the inclusion of women among the ordained ministry. The gender barrier was broken, and the first women were ordained a year and a half to 2 years later. I remember being curious, excited, and a little frightened when ordination was open to women. I might be asked to assume a responsibility I wasn't sure I wanted. For many others, it created havoc and dissent. Estimates of those who left the church range from 15 to 30,000. And that was in a membership of approximately 220,000. So you're talking about 7.7% to 3.5% of the membership who left. The first women ordained often faced hostility from friends and family alike, or found their ministry rejected by portions of their own congregation. I was privileged to be in a congregation that embraced women's ministry freely and completely. Being ordained was like coming home. Teacher, elder, evangelist, which is the same as your patriarch evangelist. I grew with each call and again experienced helping hands along the way from men and now also from women. Meanwhile, I moved from youth ministry into full-time ministry at the Stake office. I served as executive assistant to four Stake presidents, each of whom mentored me and pushed me to expand my understanding of church structure, policy, and procedure, as well as ministry. In the role of assistant, I was both safe and empowered. I often did the work of the stake president, who I believe is similar to your bishop. Is that not correct? The administrative head? Okay. I see. Okay, then perhaps it would be the same as your stake president. He's the administrative head for our stake, for our stakes. Okay. I often did the work of the stake president quietly behind the scenes, pleased that I had expertise and knowledge that could be used. All I wanted to do was serve. And the opportunities were many and varied. As long as I distanced myself from the minority who still actively resisted women in priesthood, I felt supported, encouraged, and upheld by both men and women in the church. Interestingly enough, that changed when I entered full-time appointment for the World Church 4 years ago. With the assignment of a position of authority came deeper struggles with gender issues. As I traveled in the fields, at times I was overlooked in meetings. Men were given credit for ideas I voiced. Questions I raised were ignored or minimized until they were championed by a man. I found it necessary to prove myself over and over. Why? What had changed? Here's one possibility. As long as I was in the background, assisting the men, not claiming credit, and wielding only borrowed authority, I posed no threat. It was safe to open doors of opportunity for me because I was behind the scenes. For the most part, that wasn't intentional, it just was. My last stake president changed that. Although he consulted me as a colleague, he took the reins of leadership firmly into his own hands and worked independently of me. Intentionally, he no longer empowered me in behind-the-scenes ministry. Instead, and at Mark Shearer's instigation, I might add, he arranged for me to enter the Master's in Religion program and encouraged me to become an appointee in my own right. Given a position of authority, I became visible in leadership and therefore posed a threat to any leaders or members who were still struggling with the gender issues. Our church is a diverse community of individuals who carry a variety of perspectives on women in ministry. Many are still coming to terms with that reality and struggling to understand the differences in leadership styles that women bring to positions of authority. Speech habits, jokes, expectations, assignments are affected by old gender models that are difficult to overcome. Becoming sensitive takes time, effort, and concentration, with multiple relapses being the norm. And many folks who truly wish to embrace gender equality haven't a clue how to go about doing it. Now, this isn't unique to the community of Christ. You will find the same difficulties being experienced in any organization, any institution that makes the journey from patriarchy to gender inclusiveness. This is normal. Here's another possibility for why I experienced more difficulty once I became visible in my leadership. I grew into my ministry among people who knew me for many years, who respected and accepted my leadership long before women were ordained. I was a known quantity, loved and honored for who I was. As an appointee, however, I transferred to other locations. I traveled among those who had no history with me and no reason to respect or trust me. The new kid on the block always is going to be challenged and tested. Being a woman doesn't exempt you from that. It only increases the heat in the trial by fire. Here's another piece of the puzzle. The church was used to primarily one style of leadership with only slight variations. Not only do women bring new styles of leadership into play, but society as a whole has begun exploring team building, side-by-side leadership models, the wounded healer paradigm, those kinds of things. Change is occurring, but old ways die hard. And my softer style of leadership is not always understood or welcomed by those who are used to patriarchy and top-down management. It takes time, re-education, and patience to use alternative styles and still be seen as firm and strong. Honesty compels me to admit that paranoia also enters in. A few experiences of discrimination and rejection of my ministry act like allergens. They sensitize a person and cause mistrust and defensiveness in what would otherwise be normal situations. Now, if an idea of mine is not well received in a meeting, I find myself wondering, is it because the idea is bad, or is it because I'm a woman? When somebody approaches me with caution and distance and coolness, is it because of their personality or mine, or is it because I'm a woman in ministry? You see how insidious it is, and I have to work against that all the time. That's just one of my little failings that you need to know about, but it's common among women in ministry. My daughter Christy researched and wrote her master's thesis about women in top leadership in the Community of Christ in 2003. As of August of that year, 19 individuals, that's 15%, of the 127 full-time paid appointees were women, including one woman in the presiding bishopric and three women serving on the Council of 12. Now there are four. 36% of the field specialists were women, and 59% of those who worked at our church headquarters were women. 32% of our 21,555 lay ministers, 32% were women. Women still comprise a small number of the higher paid, greater decision-making positions in the church, while at the same time they make up a large number of the lower paying, least decision-making positions in the headquarters offices. 13 of the 19 women serving in top leadership positions were interviewed, and similar experiences emerged as commonalities among the participants. On the positive side, commonalities included a deep sense of call and commitment, a long history of preparation prior to serving, great love for the message, the mission, the vision and goals of the church, a desire to help the church and its members become all that it can be. There were also common stories that emerged concerning the struggles they had faced in previous years in being hired and accepted in their ministry. These include inappropriate questions or comments during the hiring process, instances where male colleagues suppressed their voice of representation, times when their ideas were ignored, responsibilities not given or summarily taken away because of their gender, situations where they were bypassed in favor of people who were more patriarchal and hierarchical in nature, not feeling their leadership styles were valued. Like many issues in our denomination, great diversity still exists within the North American Church concerning individual and congregational support for women in ministry. Most of our congregations have embraced and empowered women in ministry, but there still exist a few congregations that refuse to ordain women and do not accept the ministry of visiting guest ministers if they are female, including myself. In general, percentages of women in ministry have not changed significantly in the last 3 years, yet progress has occurred. Awareness of gender issues has increased. Training has occurred on boundary issues, inappropriate gendered behavior, and harassment. Mentoring of leadership has increased in frequency and quality. Awareness of variety in leadership styles is being acknowledged and explored. I will close with a brief testimony of my own sense of my call to apostle. Although I did not have that sense of call when Steve Veazey asked me to serve, about a week later, as I was in a staff meeting, God has a sense of humor, because I was supposed to be keeping this confidential. Nobody could know, right? But my confirmation came in a public setting, in a worship service, when a staff member presented to us a scripture for our consideration. That scripture was from the Gospel of John, the 20th chapter, where the 11 apostles had gathered in fear and trembling, right? Behind locked doors, afraid on the night of the resurrection, not knowing what to expect. And suddenly Christ stood in their midst, and he said to them, "Peace be unto you. As God has sent me, so I send you." As that scripture was read in my presence in that worship service, I felt the incredible flooding of God's Spirit through my being and this welling up of a conviction that God was calling me. It was as if Christ himself stood before me and said to me, "Susan, be at peace. As God has sent me, so I send you." And the meaning of the word apostle is one who is sent. Because of that overwhelming experience of the calling of Christ in my life, I am now an apostle. So I travel around ministering to people, teaching, preaching, solving problems, or creating them. I like to think solving them. Sharing my testimony, my apostolic witness of Jesus Christ with those for whom I am supervising and ministering and apostling. It is a joy to serve in this role. There are challenges ahead for the community of Christ in areas where women in ministry are still not accepted, but we're getting there, and we're making progress. And under the leadership of Steve Vesey and with the support of the other members on the Council of 12, I feel empowered in my ministry.
I must admit that I'm rather irritated sitting here next to Susan Skor, an ordained apostle in the community of Christ. I'm not irritated by her, of course. Like all of us, I think she's just wonderful. No, what really irritates me is that there are several women here at Sunstone, as well as others who are not here, who are completely qualified to be ordained apostles in the LDS Church, who would serve well, and who would raise the level of our organization, but who are shut out from leadership roles because of their gender. Just to be clear, I do not include myself in this group. I thought I was all talked out on this subject, but I find I have a thing or two more to say. In 1984, I had one of the shining epiphanies in my history as a Mormon woman. Margaret Toscano's first paper at Sunstone, entitled "The Missing Rib, The Forgotten Place of Queens and Priestesses in Zion," detailed all the evidence from early church history that women were intended by Joseph Smith to function in a priesthood role. The paper was such a sensation that she presented it a second time during the lunch hour at Sunstone so more people could hear it. That paper changed every paradigm for me. I have never been the same since I heard it. I came away inflamed with hope for Mormon women and with a clear vision for the future. Other churches were ordaining women to the priesthood out of a simple sense of fairness, inclusion, and equity, while our church had solid historical reasons and evidence to support such a policy. No other church had such a legacy. All we had to do was make sure everybody understood it, and a change would certainly be almost automatic. I threw myself into the effort, not as a writer, but as a doer. I asked uncomfortable questions. I joined in women's causes. I started a women's discussion group. I objected. I gained a reputation. These days, however, I feel that the fight for women's equality in the Mormon Church is over. Our efforts to change the institution have been without effect. We haven't changed a thing. In fact, women's official status in the church is worse now than when we started. We have little hope left. Our leaders have given up and dropped out or been subjected to church discipline or otherwise driven away. There is no one to take our place in the struggle because many of our daughters have seen the situation for what it is and have opted out. The patriarchy has prevailed, and Mormon women today are pretty much defined by male Mormon leaders. I've heard the Relief Society described as the largest women's organization in the world that is run by men. I recently came back from living for three years in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. While there, I connected with the remnants of the ERA fight in Oklahoma, where the results there were about as devastating as they were here in Utah. I chaired a panel for that group, the Bartlesville Women's Network, also entitled Women in the Ministry. On that panel besides me were Mother Andrea Jones, Associate Pastor of St. Luke's Episcopal Church, Catherine Reese, a minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church, and Sister Marilyn Brinker, a chaplain at Jane Phillips Hospital and a Catholic nun who favored ordination for women. It soon became clear that we were divided, like this panel, into the haves and the have-nots. Sister Marilyn, the nun, and I were like children pressing our faces to the window of a candy store, longing and looking, but not allowed in. The two ordained women, on the other hand, the Episcopalian and the Unitarian, were functioning as leaders in their churches with an enviable degree of comfort and security, having left behind most of the angst that activist Mormons and Catholic women experience. Although Mother Andrea did describe the sufferings of the first generation of ordained Episcopal women who were sometimes spat upon and sprinkled with blood, she acknowledged that those women paid the price for the acceptance she now enjoyed. I learned from that panel about how other churches that now ordain women move towards their present position. Mother Andrea, the Episcopal priest, explained that her church had done a careful study of the scriptures and could find no prohibitions other than cultural ones to women being ordained. In other words, they developed a theology to support ordination. As part of that study, they emphasized all instances of women in leadership roles in the early church. They developed role models. Then they worked towards priesthood for women through a series of steps, one of the first being to expand the role of women in leadership without ordination. Now, Mormonism has two of the three. We have a good theology supporting ordination, especially where the temple ceremony is concerned, and we have good role models, at least if we go back to the 19th century. But despite some general conference addresses on women, including women more in discussions at the ward level, we have made no significant advances in expanding women's voices in church governance. Not that there haven't been attempts. I have witnessed some local LDS efforts to do this. For instance, the stake president of the Walnut Creek, California stake called all the leaders of the stake women's organizations into a meeting and asked us what issues were paramount for the women of the stake. He had someone take notes. The lack of nursing facilities in one building was mentioned. I brought up the inequity at that time of allowing non-member fathers to stand in baby blessings, but not temple-endowed mothers. The stake president set a meeting for 5 weeks from then and returned to report to us that renovations were underway in the building without nursing facilities and that he had cleared it with the regional representative that mothers who specifically asked to stand in baby blessing circles would be allowed. I recognize that all of this required permission and support from the priesthood leaders, but at least he asked, listened carefully, and gave action rather than reasons why our concerns weren't legitimate. The renovation was permanent. The policies on mothers participating in baby blessings vanished when that stake president was released. Another case occurred in the Oakland, California stake, where two women were called as assistant stake clerks and sat in on all stake presidency meetings. This gave them the titles, but not the power. As they reported, "We were in the room, but not in the game." This arrangement lasted until a visiting general authority put an end to it. My experience with attempts to increase the role of women in the LDS Church without priesthood is that they are like snow. They last only as long as a sympathetic man is in power and then melt away with his successor. In addition, even baby steps are squashed by higher authorities. Point number one. Given LDS traditions and culture, I believe priesthood is a requirement for any sort of true organizational power for women. How could we implement priesthood for women in a practical sense in our church? A former bishop and I came up with some incremental steps. One, include women in all ward leadership meetings, including PEC. Two, create a third counselor position in all bishoprics and presidencies held by a woman without priesthood. 3, make priesthood optional for women. 4, eliminate the third counselor and have ordained women take over as second counselors in bishoprics and presidencies. 5, as in other churches, we could expect the first generation of women leaders to experience a lot of bumps. Here are some other options. Have women's quorums of Melchizedek priesthood. Have separate but equal priesthood. Women take Aaronic, men take Melchizedek. The disadvantage of this idea is that women would still be in an inferior role by tradition. Make priesthood optional for both men and women. Probably a lot of men would cheer for this idea. Point 2. Changes will be more likely to start in the far-flung areas of the church where the need for leadership will be the driving force. It will become increasingly impossible to ignore the strong source of leadership represented by women if the church is to continue growing. For instance, in those remote units, a Relief Society president might oversee a dependent branch. A woman might serve as branch clerk. Now, here's an important question. Do LDS women really want the priesthood? To be honest, most would not, at least as conditions stand now. Many women would feel very uncomfortable with the notion and wouldn't know what to do with it. Mormon women have few role models to look to in church leadership. Many would feel it's just another burden and obligation. Many would want the authority to bless, but would shrink from any sense of priesthood as organizational power. We have been socialized to feel sinful if we want power. We don't want to perish while attempting to steady the ark. To address the issue of women in power, let me read you some quotes on this subject from Lori Winter Stromberg's wonderful article entitled Power Hungry, which appeared in Sunstone in December 2004. I quote, "If by power hungry you mean I desire the ability not only to accept responsibilities in the institutional church, but also to be part of defining those responsibilities, then yes, I'm power hungry. If by power hungry you mean I believe women must have a voice in the church, then yes, I'm power hungry. If by power hungry you mean I believe that women should not only be represented, but should also be an integral part of every major decision-making body of the church, then yes, I'm power hungry. If by power hungry you mean I would welcome a heightened ability to bless the lives of others, then yes, I'm power hungry. Finally, if by power hungry you mean I want the ability to participate in a model of power based on partnership rather than patriarchy, based on empowerment rather than domination, then yes, I'm power hungry." End quote. If it is no sin for men to want these things, why is it a sin for women to want them? However, even among those who want priesthood, some might not want the kind of priesthood currently in place for fear that women will be corrupted as surely as men. Unrighteous dominion can take hold of women too. In preparing for this panel, Bill Russell, a professor at Graceland University, gave me an insight into the RLDS version of this worry at the time that priesthood was voted for women. He said, quote, "Many RLDS women prior to 1984 said, I don't want the priesthood. But that avoided the question as to whether it should be available. Madeline Brunson, at the time the church archivist, wrote an article in Dialogue on how she agonized about whether to vote for the document that was approved and became Section 156, granting priesthood to women. She tended to think it would not be good for women to be absorbed into a hierarchical system. She finally voted for it because the arguments against it by the fundamentalists were so repugnant. Point 3, every group that is lacking in power can rise in power only if they have allies in the existing power structure. For example, Afro-Americans were freed from slavery and later gained their civil rights partly from their own efforts, but also partly because they had sympathizers among whites. How did the ordination for women come about in the community of Christ? Susan said, told me that it came from the bottom up through local efforts leading to public discussion, leading to a vote by members or delegates. However, it also came from the top down with a friendly stance by the highest levels of authority. Neither of these conditions exist in the LDS Church. There is no public discussion or meaningful vote in the LDS Church. We say that we vote, but we only pretend to. A very small group consisting of the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve makes all significant decisions. The membership as a whole is largely voiceless. There is no way in place for change from the bottom up. Given our extreme emphasis on hierarchy and authority, the allies that we need would have to be at the very top of the organization and would have to be willing to take real risks. I don't see any of the top group willing to advocate for women at this point. It's not that we lack allies. We have plenty of sympathetic men in the church, but they are below the level of the Quorum of 12 and can make little headway on this issue. It may also be true that even those in the Quorum of 12 can make little difference if they lack seniority. We are lacking allies among the top leadership. I don't know how to overcome this obstacle. As I have heard it said, change comes to the LDS Church in two ways, slowly and not at all. On the positive side, priesthood ordination for women would be better accepted here than in the community of Christ because we are an obedience culture. We would have some membership losses, but not wholesale ones. Maybe 1%, maybe less would be my guess. This is much less than the community of Christ experienced. Moving forward, I continue to hope, but without much hope. I guess you could call it hopeless hoping. Meanwhile, many women tend to lapse into inactivity or leave, especially younger women who have significant roles in other power structures through careers and social service and see no reason to be submissive in things religious. Molly Bennion wrote an essay entitled A Lament in the most recent Dialogue. In it, she documents the loss of many intelligent, capable women and details the reason she is seen for this outflow. She says, some of the missing attend other churches. Some have found non-traditional spiritual outlets. Some express no interest in religious issues. But they are not the chaff. We are not better off without them. Older women are leaving too. My mother specifically boycotted church service during the 80s, saying that she was not interested in contributing to any organization where she had no chance of being president. On the other hand, I would like to acknowledge that there is a quiet, under-the-table ministry that goes on among Mormon women. We heard in one session of this symposium about a Relief Society president who found herself in the position of hearing confessions from sisters who did not want to talk to the bishop. This president absolved these women and gave them relief from their burdens. There are women's blessings that continue to take place without official sanction. Women's retreats continue to enrich lives. And women choose their own ministries, as Nadine will describe more to you. In trying to think of a good ending for this paper, it occurred to me that it's ludicrous for me to be on a panel talking about women in the ministry, since all I can do is analyze why women aren't in the ministry in the LDS Church. Instead of talking to the subject, I'm forced to tell you why I can't talk to the subject. What I would really like to have delivered in this paper is not a rousing finish, but the story of a good start towards recognizing the gifts and abilities and wisdom of women. I'm sorry that's not the paper I can give. Thank you.
Before I start, I have to correct one thing that Levina said. I think there was a woman named Hansen who wrote an article about an attorney looks at the ERA or a lawyer looks at the ERA, but it wasn't me.
Well, I'm a treating attorney.
Okay. At the time of the ERA, I was not yet a lawyer, so I know it was not me. I do remember reading that article, though. I don't remember who wrote it. Ministry is a word with a variety of meanings in both the religious and political context. In the political realm, as well as in the religious sense, a minister is a powerful ruling figure. In another religious sense, a minister is a servant who literally ministers to people's spiritual and temporal needs, or as one web definition put it, a ministry is a way of serving and caring for others in Christ's name. In the LDS Church, these two meanings of ministry are largely bifurcated, with men, the official ministers, being the ruling administrators, and women doing much, though certainly not all, of the work of ministering to people's needs. Women do much of their ministering through the church's men's organization for women, the Relief Society. I've done my share of that kind of ministry, taking meals to those in need, tending the children of sick mothers, providing transportation and companionship to the elderly, and just being there for someone who needed to talk. That is a very real and important kind of ministry, beneficial to the recipient and satisfying to the giver. But as we all know, LDS women are excluded from formal ministry that comes from priesthood. If I have had a ministry, a unique calling, it has been that of an educator, a consciousness raiser about women's inequality. For the last 25 plus years, in a variety of ways, like Vicki, I have attempted to raise awareness within my local congregations about social justice issues in general and women's equality in particular. At the local level, I have quietly but persistently spoken up, affirming women's equality and pointing out inequality where I've seen it. I've recounted the stories of the capable and powerful powerful women from the Mormon past, demonstrating that there have always been strong Mormon women who were encouraged to take on non-traditional roles. It was hard and even scary at first, but I got better at it as I practiced. And over time, people came to expect and value my comments. I knew I had made a difference when someone in Relief Society made a somewhat sexist statement, then immediately said, "Nadine, don't you have something to say about that?" I have also tried, but with less success, to make a difference in the larger church community, speaking and writing, and in Don Quixote fashion, tilting at the church's institutional windmill of sexism, dreaming the impossible dream of gender equality within the church. So here are some highlights from my journey and struggle with issues of women in ministry. One afternoon in June of 1978, I had the radio on to listen to the news on the hour. When I heard the announcement that the Mormon Church, claiming revelation from its prophet, would now ordain black men to the priesthood, I was overjoyed at this elimination of the church's longstanding racism. I silently thanked God, then almost immediately thought, "And what about women?" I had long chafed at the church's attitudes toward women, and I suppose that the realization that the church could change a long-standing racist practice gave me a glimmer of hope that its sexist practices could also change. At that time, the church's campaign against the Equal Rights Amendment was underway, and while I knew that the church was opposed to the ERA, I did not yet know how thoroughly embroiled the church was in the politics of stopping three more states from ratifying it and making it part of the Constitution. In the next few months, Sonia Johnson's pro-ERA testimony before a Senate subcommittee would make the news, and her subsequent excommunication would make headlines all over the country. In the wake of these events, I learned that I was not the only feminist in the LDS Church, and I learned that there was a vigorous intellectual community that had publications like Dialogue and Sunstone and Exponent 2. I had felt very isolated before that. Not long after I read my first issue of Dialogue, I had the thought, someone should write an article for Dialogue arguing that women should have the priesthood. Almost like a ton of bricks, a little voice in my head said, "You should write it." The thought made my palms sweat and my stomach churn. But I went to the library and checked out every book I could find about women who had been ordained to the ministry within their own faith traditions. I wrote the article, Women in Priesthood, and it was published in, I think, about 1980. To the best of my knowledge, this was the first published article to address this subject. Mind you, at the time, I wasn't a lawyer or a writer or an intellectual or even an openly avowed feminist. I was a mom with four kids, back in school, working on an undergraduate degree, not knowing what I would do with said degree when I got it. I can't tell you how nervous I was about publication. While the article seems tame today, there was more than one pre-publication night when I literally woke up in a cold sweat over the cultural taboo that I was about to violate by advocating priesthood for women. A few years later, I got a phone call one evening from my friend George Smith, who informed me that the prophet had had a revelation and women were going to get the priesthood. I think I responded with something like, "Sure, George, and I'm the Pope." George reassured me that he wasn't joking, that the prophet really had received a revelation granting women the priesthood, but it was the prophet of the RLDS Church. I have to admit to a little cynicism. I was well aware that the office of prophet was, by practice of the RLDS Church, a hereditary office, and the current prophet had no sons. Still, whatever the reasons for the revelation, and Susan has shared with us the real reasons of how this came about, I was pleased for my RLDS sisters. I was even happier for them a couple of years later when I attended a session at the Sunstone Symposium and heard firsthand the stories and experiences of some of the first RLDS women who had said yes to the call of being ordained to the priesthood. It was one of the most memorable Sunstone sessions I've ever attended, and I suggest that no one who listened to these women could have reasonably questioned what a wonderful blessing it had been, both for the women and for their church, to include women's strengths and gifts in formal ministry. Over the next two decades, I presented paper after paper and participated in panel after panel at Sunstone Symposia and other independent forums regarding women's roles in the church. I argued for broader participation in church roles with or without priesthood, as Susan has told us and as Vicki advocated, that the reality is that there are lots and lots of positions in the LDS Church that don't require priesthood, but that are always filled by a priesthood holder. And it would be a giant step just to include women in those callings that don't really require priesthood. And when it comes right down to it, there really are not very many that actually require priesthood. I criticized stereotypical roles. I pointed out the inherent inequities involved in practices such as requiring married women's husbands' permission before extending callings to women. I think that is the one thing that has changed. I think that is no longer the official policy of the church. It still happens, but I think that officially that instruction on extending callings has been withdrawn. And in subjecting women to church discipline at the hands of men. I deconstructed talks by general authorities, explaining why things they said that purported to elevate women really just kept women in their subordinate place. I tried to come up with and counter all of the reasons I could think of for excluding women for the priesthood. I did a series of talks or panel presentations about the proclamation on the family, carefully parsing its words and pointing out that its assertion that husbands and wives are in some way equal partners notwithstanding, the proclamation does not support the reality of women's equality with men. I asked the question, is gender eternal and why should we care? Pointing out that not only did the proclamation not place men and women on equal footing, but worse than that, it locked women into an eternally subordinate role with its assertion that gender is an essential characteristic of the individual's premortal, mortal, and eternal identity. For the first time, our subordinate role became part of our nature rather than just part of our fallen state. And I think this is a sense in which Vicki has already mentioned that in that sense, women are worse off now than they were 20 or 30 years ago. In my discussion of the proclamation on the family, I have hoped to give LDS leaders pause to think twice and three times and then think again before canonizing the proclamation, because canonization would then provide a scriptural basis for further discrimination against women. I know that at least some people in the church office building heard what I had to say, because they tattled on me to my stake president, even suggesting to him that President Hinckley himself was offended by my presentation. So they heard, but I don't know whether they listened. I sincerely hope that for the well-being of the church, as much as for the well-being of women in the church, the proclamation on the family will eventually go the way of all other proclamations that the church has promulgated, fading out of the popular Mormon consciousness and into the complete obscurity it deserves. It would, in my opinion, be a very, very big mistake to elevate this highly sexist, homophobic document to the status of scripture. If the proclamation is never canonized, I will never know whether my critiques of it had anything to do with the decision not to make it scripture, but I may at least entertain the fantasy that my words have accomplished one worthwhile thing. All of my efforts over more than two decades to subtly and not so subtly encourage the church away from its sexism have earned me several sessions in my bishop's and stake president's offices, but haven't yielded much in the way of improvement in the status of women in the church. Indeed, when the dialogue editors contacted me a few years ago about republishing my Women in Priesthood article in an anniversary issue, I think in the year 2000, and asked whether I wanted to make any changes, so little had changed for women in the 20 years since publication that I didn't feel I needed to change a thing. It's pretty discouraging to think that the church could go through a full generation of the women's movement while changing so little. Like Vicky, I am tired of having sops tossed my way, of hearing patronizing instructions on the rightness and propriety of an ostensibly benevolent patriarchy that wears a velvet glove over its fist of the threat of excommunication for those who dare call the church's sexism what it is, sinful oppression of half or more of the members of the church. I don't want to be told how important women are, how loved we are, how valued we are. I don't want to be patted on the head and told that the church's definition of gender roles exists for my benefit as a woman because it is my nature to nurture and a man's nature to lead. What I want is for church leaders to get it through their very thick skulls that they need to stop justifying their sexism and start understanding just how sexist they are, because highly sexist they are, and to expend their energies in rooting out their sexism rather than proclaiming that women's subordination to men is an integral part of God's plan. Women have proven their God-given abilities to function in every kind of societal role imaginable, including ministry in many churches. Given what women have accomplished in all walks of life, the formal ministry of LDS priesthood would be a piece of cake. The truth is that it isn't God excluding women from priesthood. It is a handful of men who proclaim themselves to be prophets, seers, and revelators, but who plainly lack the prophetic vision that our LDS leaders had 22 years ago when God spoke to them and told them not to wonder that some women would be called to the work of ministry. I attended the Mormon Feminist blog session on Thursday. I am thrilled to know that there are young Mormon feminists who are willing and able to carry on the necessary dialogue about women in the church. More correctly, I guess it is a monologue of sorts, as church leaders stubbornly refuse to dialogue in any meaningful way about women's roles in the church. They choose instead to justify, pacify, and when all else fails, intimidate. After more than 25 years of trying to make a difference, of trying to raise consciousness, of asking nicely, of suggesting nicely, of making impassioned pleas, of making reasoned arguments, I'm not optimistic about the future of women in the LDS Church. Maybe things will change when younger men rise to the church's hierarchy to positions of power, but when they arrive, they will no longer be younger men. To put it in perspective, the man who orchestrated the church's anti-ERA campaign against women's civil rights in the United States nearly 30 years ago is now president of the church and is either unwilling or unable to understand that the church desperately needs the full participation of women in all aspects of church governance. As I listened to the young feminist bloggers on Thursday, I realized that I'm not even sure anymore what feminist issues are for young women. I've decided to dig out and dust off my computer files about women in the church and find a place for them in the blogosphere if I can figure out what that place is. Maybe there are young women out there that can find something of value in them, something they can build on. I am ready and willing and eager to pass the torch. Perhaps a new generation of Mormon feminists can succeed where my generation has largely failed. For the good of the church, as well as for their personal good, I hope they can. an all-male hierarchy is increasingly irrelevant to women who have grown up with the benefits of the second wave of, that the second wave of feminists fought so hard for in the 1960s and 70s, to women who take for granted their essential equality and their equal opportunity. When I was young, I dreamed what was, for our generation, the impossible dream for a church where, as Paul said, there is no more male nor female, but all are one in Christ Jesus. May it, in the future, be a possible dream.
Well, I think we've had three superbly prepared and passionately delivered presentations today, for which I am expressing the gratitude of everyone in this room to our presenters. And we have... And they very considerately left us almost half an hour for questions and actions and interactions. And I first want to give them the opportunity to ask each other questions or to respond to what each other has said. But I also wanted to mention something else. I know that for at least some of you in this room, Susan is the first ordained woman that you have encountered. And for many of you in this room, she is the first ordained apostle. It's obvious to all of you that she is comfortable and competent speaking for her church as an apostolic representative, but I ask you also to be sensitive to the fact that she is an individual and not ask her to interpret the entire mind of the church or the will of God in your questions. But respect and appreciate her individuality, which is one of the great gifts that she has given us today. As you know, in these sessions, we want people to speak into the microphone so that that information will be available on the tape. But I would first like to see if the panelists would care to respond to each other, either with a question or a comment.
Well, in scoping out this panel, you know, I had a little talk with Susan, I had a little talk with Nadine to sort of see where we were positioned, and I thought Nadine was going to be the nice, sweet, friendly one. All I could say is she said some things I didn't dare say.
Comments and questions from the audience, and please direct them to whomever you wish to respond. Why are the men lining up?
I think that's heartening in and of itself that the men are lining up. In listening to this presentation, I was long an advocate and critic of blacks being excluded from the priesthood, and I wrote extensively on that. And I've also been very interested in the movement of the RLDS, now the Community of Christ, and I've kind of followed that. And I found it interesting, what would it take? I think the bottom line question, and I think it really goes to the heart of what you people were talking about, what would it take for the LDS Church to move to a position of empowering women, whether it be through some kind of priesthood authority or movement in that direction. I think that's really the absolute bottom line question. I considered the paradigm that was suggested, what happened in the Community of Christ in your church, and it was a very liberal leadership at the top that I think was energized in that direction, and then some grassroots support, although there, as you pointed out, there was a lot of grassroots support that opposed that, but you know, as correctly pointed out, I can't remember whether it was Nadine or the presentation by you, that we don't have those conditions within the LDS church. So, you know, I don't think the RLDS role model, you know, the RLDS paradigm would fit. What I think it would take is what it took to give blacks the priesthood. It would take a compelling situation where the rubber meets the road. The question is this. In the international church and within the LDS church, I understand that in a lot of areas of the world there's a disproportionate number of women as opposed to men in congregations. And my question is this: would that be the way, rather than, you know, happening in the United States domestically as a result of feminist issues and the increasing empowerment of women within the United States? Would it be the international situation
okay.
more than the domestic? I'm directing that toward the two of you, and maybe even Levina.
I told Levina that I wanted to respond to this question, and so she sent me up here. I have thought about that, and I do think that the church responds to compelling needs in making changes. Certainly it did in with blacks, especially in the country of Brazil, where you couldn't tell who was of African ancestry. I have heard that I don't even know if this is true, but somebody on it sent an email once that said that it was in the United States, actually, but they were in a place where they didn't have enough boys to pass the sacrament, and there was a visiting general authority, and he said to have the girls pass it. Now, that's such an easy thing that could be done, because you don't really have to have priesthood to pass the sacrament. Women pass it to each other along the rows, and if they would start letting 12-year-old girls pass the sacrament, I sort of have a 10 or 20-year plan for the church for how they could ordain women, and it starts out with what we've already talked about, allowing women a broader role within the church and empowering them to have roles that, or to have church callings that don't absolutely require priesthood. I think that would be the very first step. That would be a very easy one to take, and I think that, as Newell said, in areas where there's a lack of male leadership, it's a natural step. The second thing I think they need to do is turn the church's propaganda machine loose on Mormon women's history, and put these wonderful stories in the ensign, these wonderful empowering stories of women who did amazing things in the 19th century and who gave blessings and who administered to the sick and who went off to medical school at a time when women didn't do that. And just build up the idea that women are, as Brigham Young said, useful not only to have babies but to study physics and law and all those things that he said in that famous quote that is tossed around quite often. And then I think that we could very easily expand that into priesthood roles for women. And in fact, after 4 years, if you started allowing 12-year-old girls to pass the sacrament, in 4 years, when they're 16 and they can't be ordained to bless the sacrament, I think it would be very easy to ordain them into the Aaronic priesthood. So I think there are things the church could do, but it's not going to happen at least until we go to a few more funerals.
Well, Levina, I hope when the women take over, they don't discourage the men from lining up.
I like to see men.
Good. I really enjoyed all of your presentations, and I think that the level of both the articulateness of the presenters and the level of preparation illustrates why we've got to have women in the leadership of the church. I mean, this is much different than a priesthood meeting. And And the difference is wonderful. Now, my wife and I have had a lot of good-natured arguments over this subject, and I always take the position that women should hold the priesthood. And in her good-natured way, she says, well, that would be a disaster because what would keep the men in the church? Already the church appeals to more women than it does men. And if men couldn't lead, would we suddenly have a church that would be mostly women? And I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
I was in a women's study group in California, and one of the sessions that we had was, what changes would you make if you were the prophet of the church within 2 hours of being ordained? So we listed them all up on the board. You know, we put them on a pad, and we concluded at the end of every one that men would leave the church in droves. We finally just made an acronym out of it, you know, WMW, so on. We discussed this. Carolyn Pearson happened to be in the group, and we were talking about how it would be, you know, that women were so much more spiritually attuned. Well, actually, we had our stake president. He agreed to come and talk to us on this subject. And he said, well, you know, women are much more naturally spiritual, and if men don't have these leadership roles, we're going to lose them. And Carolyn said, aren't we confusing the gifted and talented program with special education?
Well, I haven't done a statistical analysis of whether men have dropped out of leadership in the community of Christ because women have been included in leadership. What I can tell you is just remind you of the statistics, and that is that at this particular time, looking toward 2007, because I have all those access to all of those figures, it's my memory. Actually, let me look. As I recall, as of January of 2007, the projection, because not all of the positions are filled, but the projection is that out of 119 general officers, appointees, and field officers, 17 will be women, which is 14% of those top leadership positions. As far as I can tell, that is not keeping the men from applying for appointment, from gaining appointment, and from serving in the church. Of the field specialists, which is kind of like one step down from appointment, they don't have to have a master's degree, for instance, to be a field specialist. There are 178 field specialists. 38 of them will be women, which is 33%, a third. So at this point, I don't know what the statistics are. My guess is it has not affected men's ability to minister or the membership of the men dropping because women are now in leadership. Except, you have to remember, the 15 to 30,000 who left the church, but that was both men and women. Generally, it was families, whole families that left, not just one gender or the other.
All right, I'm a big fan of bell hooks. And like her, I believe that feminism isn't something that just helps out women, but it's ultimately something that should and does benefit all of humanity, all of everyone, almost said mankind. And so my question is mostly directed to Apostle Susan here. What positive benefits have you seen in the lives of men, especially as fathers and husbands, and in children, as women have become a larger part of the ministry?
I'm glad you asked that question because I do see positive benefits. There are some differences, perhaps socially or socialized or innate, and I'm not going to argue that point right now, between the way in which most women lead and the way most men lead. I think it's primarily socialized. But what's happened is that we have seen a broader expanse of leadership styles among the men as well as the women. Men who have found the courage, shall we say, to begin developing side-by-side leadership, team leadership, more of a softer approach, grassroots cooperative leadership, because the women have been on board to model that. We have seen a strengthening, I believe, of the family unit because men and women in our denomination see each other as equally empowered and spiritual beings whom God blesses in a variety of ways. There are households where the woman, for instance, is an elder and the man is a priest. Initially, they thought that would be a huge problem, create divorce and things like that. That has not been the case. We have seen mutual support for priesthood offices, regardless of where they fall in the, quote, hierarchy of offices. In general, we have seen an experience with children who are growing up in a society now, Community of Christ Society, where the gender equality empowers them to begin taking on leadership actions, shall we say, when they're very young. Both women, both girls and boys, will offer prayers, will be involved in public ways, in giving little speeches or testimonies or things like that. And that is creating a deeper spirituality in them. So I see it as being a very positive thing for men as well as for women and for the family unit and the whole structure.
First of all, thank you all for your comments. They were deeply moving to me. Two quick questions, maybe not quick answers, but the first is, what are some realistic steps that men can do to help in this effort, if any? And second of all, Vicky, you mentioned that there are strong theological foundation for women being ordained to the priesthood. I've read a little bit about that, but do you have any suggestions for sources to go to or some different works that have been written on that?
As far as sources are concerned for justifying the ordination or supporting the ordination of women, you need to look at Maxine Hank's seminal work, Women in Authority. In particular, Michael Quinn's book, essay, Mormon Women Have Had the Priesthood Since, what was the year? 1843, is a good one. But that is probably the best overall survey of Mormon women's sources. Margaret Toscano's article, The Forgotten Role of Queens and Priestesses in Zion, The Missing Rib, I believe it, does that appear in her book, Strangers in Paradox, which she co-wrote with her husband, Paul. So that was the work that kind of turned my head around. What was your other question? What steps men can take? Gosh, I've never thought of it that way. I'll bet. Here comes Levina. She will resolve all. I mean, you can always be nice to us and support us.
I'm not sure that I would advocate this as a general policy, but I remember being very, very impressed at a Sunstone presentation a few years ago when Dee Green, speaking during the question-answer period, said that as a matter of policy, he would not accept a calling in the church which his wife could not. So he would teach, but high council, stake presidency, bishopric, those were out. And he said that neither he nor his wife made a big deal about it, but he just said, my wife is as qualified as I am, and if she's ineligible for a position, then I consider myself ineligible as well. So that's something.
I have to say something about that, though, because it's somewhat self-defeating. Because the men we would like to have in those positions are the men who want to empower women. So, although I appreciate the gesture, I would like you to move into the church's hierarchy and change things for us.
I have lots to say and lots of questions, but I'll narrow it down to one. Every time the idea of women being ordained to priesthood callings or even moving into callings within bishoprics and working in close contact with male leadership, invariably the argument comes up that the men and the women are going to jump into bed together and that's why we can't do it. Susan, I know you spoke a little bit about sexual harassment. Can you please dispel this myth for us?
Yes, and let me refer you to two books. Oh, sorry. Just in case you want to do a little bit more reading about the background for women in ministry, I'd like to refer you to Fiorenza, is the woman author of Woman Spirit Rising. It's a feminist work, but embodied in that book is some information about the New Testament times of Jesus and his inclusion of women among his disciples and how that empowered women. So I just wanted to mention that. And also McAfee, if I can find the name of that book. Does anybody remember McAfee's seminal work in... Okay. Anyway, that is the name, M-C-A-F-F-I-E. And that was another feminist work that was done and includes some of the background, some of the scriptural background that you might want to look at. Okay, the question. In our church, we have always said that it was wise to go two by two in ministry, and especially when women were ordained, that was stressed, that it is always wise to go two by two. And in that, it was not, we were advised not to go man and woman together two by two, that if that was the case, that you had a third as well, just to protect your own reputations and to prevent any allegations being made about the propriety of things that were going on. To tell you the truth, we had no problem, basically, in the 20 years that we've had women in the priesthood. I don't think that we have had even one instance of a priesthood member, either man or woman, being found, you know, in flagrant dialecte. Is that what it's called? Yeah. They've all been with men. Yeah. There have been, of course, the normal situations of adultery, but usually it has not been a case of two priesthood members, but rather, you know, a priesthood member who has overstepped the line with a non-priesthood member, usually a male priesthood member with a non-priesthood female. So we have not had one instance that I'm aware of, at least in those 20 years, where the two priesthood members have jumped into the sack because they happen to be ministering together. But as a result of the lack of problems, that has been relaxed. You now will find that there are occasions when a man and a woman will go and minister together with not a third person in place. To be honest with you, in my ministry, I travel so much alone. I'm all over the place in the western third of the United States, and I have men, staff members who pick me up and take me places. So we're in the car like 2 or 3 hours, sometimes driving. And at this point, nobody raises an eyebrow. Nobody has mentioned a word about that. And that has become fairly common among the top leadership of the church that will happen. So I just want you to know it has not been an issue for us. And we do not have any instances where that has become a problem. But I still recommend the two by two whenever that's possible.
I just wanted to mention that I think there are two editors on the book Woman Spirit Rising. The other one is Carol Christ, and it's spelled like Christ. So if you're looking for that book, that's the name of at least one of the editors.
You know, I forgot to mention in my talk that one of the possible options for including women in the priesthood that former bishop and I talked about was having married couples assume a single calling. Like you would have a married couple be the bishop, that sort of thing. And in fact, that is already going on. I should have mentioned this too now that I think about it, because I myself have got a priesthood calling, and many women in the church already do, but nobody is saying anything about it. You know what that priesthood calling is? Home teacher. My husband and I are home teachers. So necessity is driving some of this. And there is one chink in the armor there, right there, home teaching.
I was wondering, why do you think that the male leadership is so threatened by the idea that women could enter the leadership roles? And you know, what makes them so insecure in their own positions and their own authority that they feel threatened by the idea of someone else getting authority?
Well, I can't really get in their heads and answer that question. You'd have to ask them. Part of it is just tradition. I think they really believe that God has set this up the way it is for men to have the priesthood, and that's just the way it has to be. I mean, it's kind of like a friend of mine said, you could give women the priesthood, but it wouldn't take. it's just a male thing. It's you just have to when you look at the grand scheme of things in their view, and maybe the answer is in the Proclamation on the Family, that they really truly believe that gender is an important part of our premortal, mortal, and eternal existence, and that we were cast in these roles where there's male leaders, maybe back when we were intelligence, uncreated spirits, but it just intelligences. And so I think it's largely tradition, and I don't want to blame it on age per se, because I'm not opposed to necessarily having older people having important roles in the church, but I think these guys would have been, they were old before they were old. It's and so I just think that it's their view of the eternal scheme of things, where there's a male God and a non-visible heavenly mother and maybe heavenly mothers, and it just doesn't work any other way. And that's the only thing I can figure out. Whether that's right or not, I have no idea.
Well, the tape has clicked off, so our session is officially over, but since we're going into the lunch hour instead of into a next session, I'm arbitrarily saying that we'll take three more questions, and since my son was the third one standing in line, you can you can get back there.
I don't have a question. I have a comment, and it's, I don't think the chinks in the armor are going to make any difference, and that's from my own experience. My husband and I served a mission at Temple Square where there are only sister missionaries. Therefore, sister missionaries are the assistants to the president, the district leaders, the zone leaders, and they're fantastic. Is anybody else modeling that? No. Also, we served a mission in Russia, the far-flung corners. There are exactly two worthy priesthood holders. One of them is branch president for about 4 years when he wears out. And then the other one is branch president for about 4 years till he wears out. They had a man serving as branch clerk who was wanted by the police rather than have a woman. I don't think the chinks, necessity and ability are going to make a difference.
Thank you for that discouraging
word. I have two comments and one question. My husband and I served a mission in Zimbabwe, Africa. And we were there to set up seminaries for all the new branches that were there. We were there for CES. And it was a real eye-opener for me. I'm a convert to the church, and so indoctrinated into the fact that only men could hold these high offices and so on. I just accepted it, never questioned it until the 70s, I guess. But anyway, in Africa, we went to visit one branch. Every Sunday, we went to a different branch to get acquainted with the people in that area. And we went to this branch, and the branch president was a police captain who was hardly ever there on Sunday. And so what happened was there was a 16-year-old girl and an 18-year-old girl, and they were doing everything. We had conducting Sunday school, singing the songs, playing leading the music. They were absolutely doing everything, these two 16-year-old girls, and then leading the seminary class afterwards. So, women did help pass the sacrament because there wasn't enough priesthood. So, and my husband said there isn't anything wrong with it. My husband is a very liberal person. I don't think I don't know. Anyway, he's just really sweet, and he couldn't see anything wrong with this at all, although a couple of missionaries who were with us did see something wrong with it. But then we went to another branch where a young man and realized that all these people are black, all of them that we work with. And we absolutely loved them and adopted them, and they adopted us. And I mean, there was total love between us. But we went to this one place where we couldn't find water, and the place where we were to meet was locked. And so a young boy with a pocket knife unlocked the lock to let us into the building, and he found a place where we could get a bucket and a place where we could get water. And then I poured the water for the sacrament, and I helped serve it. So my husband thought that was just fine. We were getting the Lord's work done, and it didn't matter, you know. It just didn't matter. Get the Lord's work done. I'm sorry. And I have one more statement to make. But the statement is that I'm just so glad that every two years do we have to go and be interviewed for a temple recommend. And I'm hoping that they'll stretch that to 5. Because I hate this girding up my loins to go through this every couple of years. Not that I'm a sinner or anything, it's just that I don't like it. And then my question is for Susan. I love your peace temple. We went there a number of times because we were on a mission in Lawrence, Kansas, and we went there often, and I loved it. And I want to know, are you using it? Because I love the feeling that was there. I just felt such a peaceful feeling there. I love the little Japanese garden that you have there. So I was wondering if what you're doing in that beautiful place.
Also, let me correct myself on something I said earlier. I said that as far as I knew, there was no instance where two priesthood members, you know, had gotten themselves into trouble. I was thinking in terms of the full-time appointee line of priesthood, not the lay priesthood. We have 21,555 lay priesthood. I have no clue, you know, what all of them are doing. I would just want you to know that, you know. So I'm sure that we've had difficulties among some of the lay ministry. I was thinking when I said that of the 127 full-time top appointees, and I was trying to think of instances there. I just wanted to make that clarification because people are people. And so, yeah, we probably have had a few of those things that happen. Okay, the temple. We have just gone through a recent redesign of our whole headquarters and field operations, which has been painful, believe me. But in that redesign, one of the things that was embedded in the redesign of ministry and tasks and job descriptions is a whole new thrust on temple ministries. This was envisioned way back at the time that the document 156 was first given, and the emphasis on peace was designated as the purpose of our temple in Independence. And shortly after that, a number of temple ministries were outlined and just have never really gotten off the ground or been implemented. And now with the redesign, we're intentionally trying to do that. They focus on the various aspects of peace, such as expanding our Office of Reconciliation. We do already have in place the Peace Pavilion for children and some classes on peace and some learning and education that goes on there. But those will be expanded, and we will be doing, out of the temple will come the new impetus for priesthood education and accountability, the emphasis on environment and global peace, the emphasis on learning how to deal with our diversity of people, all the way from militarism to pacifism and everything in between. So we've got all of these temple ministries that are going to be in place and up and functioning with more power and more resources and direction than we have had in the past, and I'm looking forward to that. So thank you for asking about that. In the meantime, we do use the temple for special activities, special seminars, some office buildings that are in there. I have an office there, even though I'm never there. Some educational opportunities and classes are held in the temple. Worships are held in the temple, that kind of thing.
And I wait for the day when one of our apostles will give a list like that. I just wanted to address this point that has been brought up several times about men leaving the church if women are ordained, or the MLTCWID phenomenon here. For me personally, my mother, the illustrious moderator, was excommunicated when I was 14. I feel that God told me not to go on a mission myself. And I know many men who are towering examples of faith in the church. And I think that this idea that that men will leave the church because of a revelation on women is ludicrous. And I think if that's really a problem, that people are thinking they need to rethink that position. If we're willing to take orders from the jerks that are in leadership and at all levels in the church right now, I think the idea that we're not willing to take leadership from someone just because they're a woman is silly.
Well, that wasn't a question exactly, but it certainly was a comment. Thank you very much for your attendance and your participation. This has been a great hour.